A lot to get to here on the show. We'll hear from Cazzy Russell, first pick in the 1966 draft, number one. We'll talk to him about that experience, draft coming up on Thursday, where obviously you have a number of guys, DeAndre Ayton, others who could be in that number one spot come Thursday night in the NBA draft. We'll also hear from D. Orlando Ledbetter. We'll recap mini camp. Also, D. Orlando has been well outspoken on the relationship between the Falcons and Julio Jones and just how much fence mending might need and bridge building might there need to be done between Julio Jones and the Atlanta Falcons before all this gets done. So we'll talk to him about that coming up in just a little bit. Also, the Braves getting ready for a two-gamer against the Blue Jays, coming off 3 out of 4 against the Padres over the weekend. Could have Ronald Acuna Jr. back, maybe.
Okay.
First part of next week, depending on how the rehab goes. So we'll talk about that as well. But first, you know, we're coming off a golf major, and the U.S. Open over the weekend was won by Brooks Koepka, and he was over par. Not a single player finished the U.S. Open under par for the tournament. You had a guy go out there and shoot, what, low 60s on Sunday. Still didn't win, but everybody over par. A lot of griping about the course and how tough it was, et cetera, et cetera. Phil Mickelson taking a two-shot penalty. Mm. And one of the strangest things you've ever seen. Mm. He runs over and slaps the ball while it was still rolling. And little did we know that children everywhere were just irreparably scarred by Phil Mickelson doing that at the U.S. Open. But we bring in Christian Gokel here, who's big golf guru.
He's a guru.
That's debatable.
But you were obviously all about this going into the weekend. You're like, good. It's tough. Were you all about everybody being over par? And the fact coming down the stretch where most majors say, okay, somebody can make a birdie, make this interesting. This seemed more like Sunday. All right, who's going to bogey to lose this thing? And I saw a stat earlier today. Close to 400 double bogeys or worse during the major, which is 100 more than they've had on any tournament on the PGA Tour the entire season during any given weekend. So almost 100 double bogeys or worse every single day of the golf tournament. That's not great golf if you're going to watch it.
And 29 more than in 2004 when they played in the Shinnecock last time, when it was pretty much the same controversy. The course wasn't ready. But I think the one thing that can't be argued is this was extremely entertaining to watch. From Phil melting down to Zach Johnson, who's usually like a really low-key dude. He said it very nicely, but he ripped Shinnecock.
Yep.
But that's what the U.S. Open is. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be hard.
Exactly.
The one place I agreed with the players, though, is this. These guys make their money by putting, right? And what I was talking to BJ a little bit about this, and I sort of compared it to if you're playing the NBA Finals on a basketball court that has lumps in it. Like, everybody's playing on it, but it's not what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, sure, the fairways can be tough. The rough was insane. It's how it's supposed to be at a U.S.
Open.
So is it
the landscaper's fault?
Obviously.
So the landscaper's fault. You guys didn't give me enough time to get it right.
But then the USGA sort of got into a bickering match back and forth with some of the players. You go to Sunday, and they just make it way too easy, especially in the morning. Once the sun hit it and you saw it towards the end, it got a little bit faster and a little bit more to how it was playing. But that morning, Tommy Fleetwood put up a 63, almost set the record for the U.S. Open, because they made it way too easy to water those greens down.
Now, my thing is this. I mean, you look at what Phil Mickelson did. I mean, he obviously lost his mind a little bit. I mean, he was having fun.
It was a strategy. You didn't listen to his interview?
He was having fun a little bit.
You didn't listen to his interview? It was a strategy.
Now, in the moment, it was not a strategy.
It was totally a strategy.
In the moment,
he's a quick thinker, man.
Listen. Me and producer Jim was talking you know, before the show, that's the first time I ever seen Phil run, ever. I've never seen him run, ever.
Wait, was that classified as running?
It was a jog. I think about this. I think at a certain point, you know, I don't have a shot at winning this thing. Let me at least try to enjoy myself. Tiger's over there in 155-foot yacht. He's over there. You know, with a robe on, laughing at everybody. Look at these guys. At least I ain't make the cut. I don't got to deal with this. No, have you ever seen this many players play bad like that? The greatest play, like this bad.
2015 in Chambers Bay was the same way. It's always like this at the U.S. Open, man. And the difference between this tournament and a lot of tournaments, besides the Open Championship, is it's a rotating scene. You're never at the same course 2 years in a row. So the Masters, you know how that's going to be. A lot of the different places, the BMW Championship, you're always at the same course. These different courses have to get ready. And like I said, everything was great on the course except for the greens. And when that's a fourth to a third of the shots is on the green, and there's a difference between making them fast and hard and making them impossible to read, and that's what they did by letting them get to the shape they were. You hit a putt, and it bumps into something that it shouldn't be bumping into and kicks off and veers. These guys can't do this at this level.
Yeah, but you being our golf guru, our golf expert, the guy that plays golf all the time, did you enjoy this level of golf? Or
yeah, I think what's terrible is that Brooks Koepka is getting lost in all this. I mean, the dude literally wins the U.S. Open,
exactly.
Does push-ups for 361 days, and then comes back and wins the U.S. Open again. I mean, he out-muscled everyone. He led the tournament in driving distance the whole time. It's like it comes down to stuff like that.
It's like you ain't even. Well, I didn't even know who he was until he won it. You hear about all these storylines.
You know, he won it last year.
Huh?
He won it last year.
Well, Christian,
you didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
But I mean, can the setup be too tough? And that's the debate that obviously they're having with the USGA is like, okay, we don't mind tough, we do mind unfair, where you get penalized for even making a good shot. And as you said, there's sometimes where you putt it and it's going 10 feet off the green and you barely tapped it. I think that's where they get in trouble. I personally don't mind it when they struggle, because I think seeing the chip and putt contest out there that they have most weeks on the PGA Tour, people get used to that. Guys go out there, and it'd be no different than, you know, anything you do that you're really well at, and then you have to struggle when the competition steps up. You're used to going out there shooting 6-7 under most rounds, maybe at the very your bad rounds are for some of these guys are 1-2 under on a day, and now you're going out there shooting 6-7-8 over because it is so tough. I can see where they would get frustrated. I don't have a problem with it myself.
Again,
I want to see.
But like,
work.
Would you be okay with them just like taking and digging out like trenches in the greens that they have to hit around?
Because, yes,
like
with alligators said, and the clown's
there's
mouth.
There's a difference between making the greens fast and hard than there is making them impossible. And that's basically what it got to on Saturday. The pin placement on Saturday was borderline sadistic. I mean, you had to put it within a foot of where you wanted that ball to go, or it was off the green in a bunker in the rough. I mean, there's no way, and that's just it's not entertaining to watch, because you like to see dudes throw it close and get some shots and get the scoreboard moving up and down. But when you're having dudes hitting out of bunkers on every single hole, it's not the U.S. Open.
I mean, I guess anything that makes pros look even kind of human, that's what I like to see.
I guarantee you, Ben, if me and you went out to that course and we took 48 balls, we wouldn't make it through four holes.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, though. I mean, think about it. You always tell me how, like, what makes the greatest golfers in the world, they can hit any shot. They can hit any. Like, if, say, the only way he can get on the green, he got to put it between, you know, this bunker, and he can do it. I think it's a battle of the minds out there when you talk about the U.S. Open. Like, look, man, what I usually do is not going to work today because this, you know, these links are unforgiving. Now you got guys say, you know what, I'm gonna do it anyway. Then you got Phil. Phil just lost his mind. You know, I'm done. I'm
it was
just gonna,
strategy. You know, he didn't lose his mind. He just thinks quicker than all of us.
Did he think that was his strategy?
That was his strategy. He was like, look, I'm gonna have to chip back up. I might not get it back up. It might roll back off.
He
so I'm just gonna go and stop it here.
Trying to trot over to the ball, and then I enjoyed it. I just enjoy the fact that we lose track of the fact that golfers complain a lot, especially when conditions aren't, I don't know, favorable. Every last one of them was like, you know what? This is unfair.
And Kevin, and all that, what thing got lost too was you had a previous U.S. Open champion in Dustin Johnson. You had the Masters champion from this year chasing down last year's U.S. Open champion of Brooks Koepka.
Sure.
So it's that Sunday was what you want in every single golf tournament. You have guys known in commodities.
Oh, there were named guys there.
Chasing each other down. I mean, I thought it was a phenomenal Sunday.
No, yeah, there were named guys there when it mattered. And I think that's what you wanted a major. I don't mind them struggling as much as they mind themselves struggling. Again, I do think there is a line. How thin is that line between tough and unfair? Yeah, I don't know. I will let the guys.
Like Zach Johnson said, man, they lost it.
I'm saying I will let the golfers determine maybe somewhat where that line is. But going back to Phil Mickelson, a lot of folks saying, like, per the rules, you should be disqualified because you're hitting a ball while it's still moving. Obviously, that's a penalty. But just the spirit, I guess, of the game of, look, you obviously lost your cool. You're walking over there, slapping a ball while it's still moving. Do you think he should have been disqualified?
Well, in the letter of the law, the fact that he hit a ball while it was still moving, it's a two-stroke penalty. You're not automatically disqualified. The manner in which he did it, it probably would have been better if he had stepped away after that. Mm. But, again, if we're going by letter of the law, he should not have been disqualified.
And again, I understand that it's not within the kind of
children's watch
the guideline. Yeah, yeah. Come on, children. God. Children. Come on. If you go to Twitter,
guys, it was a beautiful strategy.
If, I mean, you don't do that.
The ball's
gone. I know,
gone,
but I'm saying, if you go on Twitter today, and you know, on the goodness. Weekend when it happened, there were kids,
yes,
who may not make it to school next year.
Come on,
because Phil Mickelson hit that ball.
I didn't think it was
there
that
were people
serious.
That might not know how golf is played.
Yeah, I was going to say
he
that.
Hit that ball. So, while I mean,
is it hockey?
When you get tweets like my children was watching this. Your children was watching a grown man run at a golf ball and hit it while it was moving. Ben, you don't understand. It's like the bat flip. You
and that's
just
when you tell
don't.
Kids, hey,
what did he look like, though? Like, when he was, like, running after that, what did he look like?
Unathletic. He looked unathletic. I mean, just he did. Listen. If the ball was any faster,
to me it kind of looks like when you're getting in your car and like a receipt blows out of your hand, you're like trying to chase it around the parking lot. That's kind of what it looked like to me a little bit.
No, it looked like a putt putt when you hit it and you like stop. That's what he did. He stopped and hit it back. If it wasn't Phil, if it was a guy that wasn't as well known as Phil, do he get disqualified? If it's not because Phil has clout in the game,
he probably steps away. Again, the USGA, with all the stuff that was going on that week, they were not going to disqualify him because they're going by the letter of the law.
I understand. Do you think he should have been? You think he should have said that was bad?
I think it's his choice. I mean,
I'm just saying, but do you think that was in?
I think a lot of it was
poor taste, so much so that he should have said, "I'm not playing."
He was right there, and this is
we've seen
his
guys
last
snap
US
clubs.
Opens.
We've seen guys snap clubs out there before.
Yeah, I mean, but this is one of his last chances to win a US Open. He's seeing Tiger, the guy he really came up with, just can't even get close right now. This is one of his last chances to win a major, and to see it, and you hit that putt and. All of a sudden, it's rolling, and it keeps rolling. You're like, that's going off the green. Tap it back up. I'm fine with it.
you're fine with it. But you also told me that the British Open might be harder than the U.S.
Me,
Open.
Excuse me. The Open Championship.
I'm sorry. The Open Championship might be harder.
For different reasons, yes.
So we got a chance.
We're going to see more meltdowns coming up in the
Lefty
month
has
of July.
Won the Open Championship. He's won the Claret Jug.
Did Phil Mickelson make himself even more famous from something that he shouldn't have done?
I think so. I think people like to rush and defend him because everybody else is jumping on him. Everybody likes a villain. All of a sudden, Mickelson's getting all this hate. People are going to come to his side. Press is good press.
Yeah, we'll get to more of that coming up in just a little bit. When we return, D. Orlando Ledbetter, AJC.com. He will join us. Falcons wrap minicamp, obviously, without Julio Jones. How much repair work is there to do between the Falcons and their number one wide receiver? We'll discuss that next here on 3 and Out on the Southern Pigskin Radio Network. Falcons wrap up minicamp over the weekend, Ben. Of course, they do so without Julio Jones. Joining us here from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, AJC.com, covers the Falcons. D. Orlando Ledbetter joins us. Daryl, welcome to 3 and Out. How are you?
Hey, guys. Thank you. I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Before we get to the Julio Jones stuff, which I know a lot of Falcons fans are looking at, what stood out from minicamp that might surprise, I guess, some Falcons fans as they get ready to jump here into 2018?
Well, you know, the defense continues to get better, and that was evident over the offseason as those guys are becoming much more comfortable as a unit and working together. You know, they just have one major hole to fill, a defensive tackle, and so everybody's back. Vic's not playing two different spots. And they look, way ahead of the curve for the offseason. That was my big takeaway from the offseason program and the minicamp.
How much better is this defense going to be with Vic Beasley back to his, true position at the defensive end position?
Well, you know, they are hoping that he can hold up against the run and get back to rushing the passer on an elite level and not just in a designated type of situation. So if he can do that and Tack McKinley can hold up on the other end of the defense, then, you know, they're hoping that might elevate the defense even more.
And again, you're talking about a defense that has gotten better every year under Dan Quinn. I know it seems like whenever he makes draft picks defensively at times, people look at him and say, was that the right move? But it seems like largely his defense has found guys to fit the right spots and continue to improve. Is this a team that can be a top 10 defense when it's all said and done?
Yeah, you know, they did end up there last year, just outside of the top 10 in passing yards, but all the other markers were inside of the top 10. So, barring any, health concerns, if everybody's able to play at the elite level, then they should move up. Losing Poe hurts. I'm sorry. He was the second most used defensive lineman, and Adrian Claiborne led the team in sacks, and he was the third most used defensive lineman. So you do have some holes over there And, you know, the one big draft mistake under Dan Quinn was Jalen Collins, and they tried to rectify that again this year by taking Isaiah Oliver in the second round. So if he can come on and be a player, that'll give them another option at cornerback. And in the passing league right now, you can never have too many cornerbacks.
Obviously, Julio Jones wasn't a mini camp. When you look at the fact that a guy like Matt Ryan doesn't mind spreading the ball around, how does a guy like Mohamed Sanu benefit from not having Julio Jones out there to kind of take the reins as the leader in that with the receivers?
Well, you know, Mohamed was able to, you know, he was the leader of the group, trying to show the young guys how to practice professionally and so forth. They were all in constant contact with Julio throughout and understood his situation. So Muhammad wasn't getting any work in Julio's spot, but, you know, as far as being the leader of the group, he was able to step up and do that this offseason for the young guys.
D. Orlando Ledbetter here joining us from AJC.com covering the Falcons. All right, Daryl, obviously a lot of Falcons fans want to know about Julio Jones, and I saw where you had mentioned to someone else in an interview you thought there was a lot of work to be done between the Falcons and Julio Jones in order to kind of repair the situation. How much distance do these two have right now?
It's quite a bit. You know, the coach preaches brotherhood and togetherness and so forth, and then you got your star player out doing his own thing this offseason when the coach was anticipating him being in camp. So, you know, they can put on whatever public face they want, but there's some bad blood between both sides in that, you know, they just did the contract in 2015, and now they want to come back in and redo it or add to it or sweeten it. You know, and the Falcons have taken a little bit aback by that. They shoot you straight on the front end and, don't really take into account market shifts. They didn't do that with Matt Ryan, but when his time came up, they dealt with him fairly and gave him a market value deal. So, you know, the fact that the deal was already done, a little bit over 24 months ago makes it real hard for the team to, go in and redo this deal.
Couldn't the team just go in and just try to restructure or reallocate some of those funds? I know how hard it is going to do a brand new deal. I know Antonio Brown's deal, I think maybe last offseason or two offseasons ago doesn't help the situation, but can't they just restructure the deal? I know it'll be hard to just give a brand new deal, but take some of the money that they owe him already within the deal and kind of like put it in the signing bonus or maybe a roster bonus or maybe a workout bonus.
Yeah, they don't owe him anything, though. He already been paid out all his cash. Everything on the back end of the contract is to be earned unguaranteed money. So there's no money sitting there to move around into previous years or subsequent years. They do have $7 million sitting there. They could take care of this year quite readily. But why do you give that money to a 29-year-old off-the-injured receiver? Even though he's very good and great, what's he going to be at 33 or 34? I mean, I don't want dead money on the books that you know is going to be dead money. So maybe the best way is to handle it on a case-by-case, year-by-year basis. But, from the team standpoint, that's certainly best. But from Julio's standpoint, if they simply put an escalator clause in the contract that says that Julio's supposed to be in the top three paid wide receivers in the league, no matter what, then, they're at the mercy of Cleveland giving Landry all this money, the Bucs giving Mike Evans all this money, the Giants going to have to do something with OBJ here in the next couple years. So, this is going to be a reoccurring theme if they, don't settle on something now.
And going back to what you were saying about the Atlanta Falcons being like straightforward guys when they're giving you your that front office being straightforward when they're giving you your contract, how much of this has more to do with the fact that they don't want to go against the grain of what they do as an organization, even if it is a guy like Julio?
Yeah, they did it though with Devontae Freeman, so that's why this thing is coming up. They went in early on his deal, and Julio's got to be thinking, well, heck, I'm better. Of more value than Devontae to the team, and the receiver prices are going up. So, if he went in 2 years early, and made an embarrassment of the team at the Super Bowl by asking for a contract when they're getting ready to play the biggest game in the franchise's history. I thought that was very poor of him and his agent to do that and take that stage and take that away from the team. And then he goes out and misses a big block in the game. So it started there, and you got to guard against all these guys wanting to walk in early to get their deals. But I don't think you draw the hard line at Julio. They should have drew that hard line back at Freeman after the Super Bowl appearance.
D. Orlando Ledbetter joining us here on 3 and Out. So at the end of the day, Darryl, how dug in are both sides on this thing? Is this something that carries over into the preseason, or is this something that the leverage of the season getting ready to start is going to force somebody to do something before actual missed games happen?
Yeah, I don't see a total holdout situation, Le'Veon Bell type deal. I see, deadlines create negotiating flashpoints, and the first deadline will be right here at, July the 27th when camps open up, and if they can get something done there. After that, the next deadline will be the third game where they would want him in, and then, you get into the season. The third level of deadlines and that stuff, if they've broken down by then you get into the whole miss 10 games, come back and play six just to get a crew year type of deal, which would be your doomsday scenario for Julio and the Falcons.
And as much as Julio knows the offense, obviously he got the rapport with Matt Ryan. How much does this hurt the offense as a whole when even though they want to run the ball, that passing game runs through number 11?
Yeah, well, Julio didn't, he had a lot of yards last year, three touchdowns, was poor in the red zone, 6-22. So, it ain't like he does need to practice. So, it wasn't like they didn't connect on their deep balls last year. So they need to get that timing back down. It would have been beneficial to being in camp. And Coach Quinn told me that much down in Orlando, that nothing really replaced practice. So, they'll just have to play catch up. They only got about 5% new things in the offense, according to Matt. So, that shouldn't be that hard to pick up. But, the timing and the fluidness, it's something that they needed to work on just to iron it out a little bit. But they do have a body of work together, and they'll have to draw on that. But even still, you'll always be thinking, well, what could have happened if they had put in this extra time? So, that's what they're faced with going into the season.
D. Orlando Ledbetter, AJC.com, our guest here on 3 and Out. Darryl, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Darryl. D. Orlando Ledbetter joining us here. And again, he says something that maybe gets forced because of some of those deadlines coming up for the NFL season. But obviously, when it comes to Julio Jones, the Falcons, obviously, with more to lose the closer it gets to the season as far as not having Julio Jones there at this stage of the game.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, it says a lot about the organization. I understand that they probably going, I didn't even know they did that with Devontae Freeman, going back to what the Orlando said. But I think you just got to do right by Julio Jones. Everybody is that exception. Sometimes you get that exception to the rule, and I think that's Julio Jones. I know he just signed his deal, 3 years ago? But when all these guys getting paid around you, and you rank, arguably number two or number three receiver, if not number one in the league, you just want to get paid. So I do think they're going to have to get a deal done here sooner rather than later.
You're coming at it from the player side, so I'll ask it to you this way. How much of it was, as he said, the Falcons feel like, hey, we made you a deal 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and at the time, everybody agreed to it. It was fair. You still have 3 years left on that deal.
Yes.
And we've lived up. We gave you all the money, a lot of the money up front. All the guaranteed money has been paid out. How much of that do you look at it and say, well, we just need to update the contract versus the team's going, hey, we worked a fair deal. Let's let this thing play itself out until we renegotiate here.
I think Julio is using a little leverage that he has left. Going back to what the D. Orlando said, he's 29 years old. He's not getting any younger. Everybody loses a step. And every little nitpick thing he said, a lot of yards last year, three touchdowns. I don't think that's Julio's fault. But how many other big contracts or how many other times in Julio's career is he going to have a chance to renegotiate? He might not get to another big deal. This might be the last big deal that he has. So I do think that at the end of the day, it's going to come down to the organization. I know Julio is using his leverage, but if they don't do what they did with Devontae Freeman, this will be easy to go and say, look, man, we're not going to bend. But I do think that Julio's just using the little leverage, if any, that he has right now.
We've got more to come here on 3 Now. We'll switch gears a little bit. We'll talk some NBA draft. Cassie Russell, he was the number one pick in the 1966 draft. We'll talk about that experience and how he feels that the draft has evolved here, where you got national TV. Obviously, you get handshake, photo ops with the commish, and more, and what these guys are expected to come in and do. He'll join us next here on 3 and Out on the Southern Pigskin Radio Network. The NBA draft, Ben, coming up on Thursday as the new wave of rookies will step into the NBA, and joining us, someone who knows what it's like to go number one overall in the draft. He did so in 1966 by the New York Knicks. Good friend of the show, Cassie Russell, joins us. Cassie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. You would have to mention 1966, wouldn't you?
I apologize. He was a first-round pick, though, in the NBA draft. We'll leave it at that. Cassie, again, on Thursday night, obviously the draft have all the pomp and circumstance. Was it that way when you went number one, and was it the big lead-up, and was there a big to-do about having a draft, being at the draft, and getting some handshakes with the commissioner like there is now when you have these drafts?
Can I say no, 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 no?
Absolutely.
It was taking place. It took place on a payphone. I was on a payphone in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and on the line was J. Walter Kennedy, Dave DeBuscher representing the Pistons, and Eddie Donovan representing the Knicks, Dave Beam, and myself. And they asked if all parties was on the line. And they asked if Mr. DeBuscher was ready, because they won the coin toss to make the call. They threw the coin up, and the coin landed on tails. And, I mean, he called tails, and it landed on heads. And away I went to New York.
Wow. I was going to say, you probably lost a lot of young folks when you said, I was standing next to a payphone. They probably didn't know what you were talking about there.
No, not at all. and I mean, in my apartment at the University of Michigan, I was living off campus for 1 year. And that's what we had. We had a payphone inside the apartment. And that's how I didn't have on a three-piece. I didn't get a chance to shake hands with the commissioner. I didn't have to put on a new hat. Didn't have any family members hugging me. It was done via the phone, and that was it. And at that time, if my memory serves me correctly, I think it was either 12 or 14 rounds. Today, what do we have, two rounds?
Yes, right.
That's it. That was the extent of it. Now, I didn't want to regurgitate all this up, but I don't mind helping you guys. Because, I do own a couple of three-piece suits, but I didn't have one at that time anyway.
Yeah, but, Kaz, when you think about it, though, I mean, that makes it even more remarkable, the fact that you went number one overall. I mean, to have 12 to 14 rounds and know out of all those guys, you was the number one pick. I mean, that's got to make you feel great about it when you look at it. And now we got the draft lottery with you. We had the coin flip. You coined that, if you even want to look at it like that.
Yeah, and I understand exactly what you're saying. You will never hear me complain. I felt like I was truly blessed to be picked number one. And I guess last year, Dave Beam called me and was on his way to Hilton Head and wanted me to come over and play golf with him. And we started talking, and he said, Cass, what do you – I said, Dave, don't even stop talking about what you think you and I would have gotten had we come out 10, 15 years later. So we had a nice laugh about that. I came out one, he came out two. At that time, obviously, he was at Syracuse, and he went to the Pistons, and I was from Michigan, and away I went to New York. So to have 12 rounds or 14 rounds, I've always felt like I was blessed. When I look back over the players that were selected, I really felt blessed that I had gone number one, especially when I had been discovered in a PE class my first year in high school.
Wow. Wow. Cassie Russell joining us here on 3 and Out. And Cassie, obviously the draft has changed a lot, but do you feel still teams are looking at it and say the draft can change the franchise? If we get the right one guy at number one, that – one guy might be enough to spin us off in a new direction.
It's possible if you've done your homework, and I'm sure all of the executives and the coaches and all of the film people have looked at, taken inventory of what they feel that their team needs. I'm certainly they have the Warriors in mind when they start picking players who can play multiple positions. I would love to just be sitting in a film room with the executives on having taken inventory and those teams who are going to be selecting 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and look at that scenario and see just what do they have in mind in terms of what they need. And that makes it fascinating, especially for teams that have 2 or 3 draft picks. But it doesn't mean anything if they don't fit your need based on how the game is going now. Do you need a point guard? Do you need a big man? Do you need a running and a shooting 3? You can always use shooters. And so they got a lot of young players, a lot of good teams who are going to try to better themselves, I'm sure, via the draft.
And Kazzy, even sticking with that, talking about what teams need, with such a high regard on putting the ball in the basket, a lot of these guys coming out of college now, they lack defense. I mean, they can put it in the basket. So if you're in these meeting rooms, what does Kazzy Russell say to any GM saying, look, I know you want to draft the guy because he can put it in the bucket, but you're looking for more of a two-way player now?
Well, that's possible. You look at a guy like Kawhi Leonard, who can play both ways. He's gifted. What is he, about 6'7"?
Yeah, he's about 6'7".
Yeah, great athlete. Again, let's go back to your taking the inventory. How was our team defensively last year? Where did we rank? Who was our defensive leader? What was our philosophy of defense? Did we see the man and the ball at the same time? How are we switching screens? See, all of those things come in as a factor when you're drafting players and when you're trying to put a team together. How does your first 5 gel defensively? How do your big guys react to screens and pick and rolls? Are we okay there? Do we need to bolster that? Do we need to strengthen that? So a lot of work goes into it. They wouldn't probably consider it work because it's their livelihood and they're trying to better themselves. Obviously, what can we do as a Houston team to better ourselves? Well, I think you missed Chris Paul, obviously, in the finals. You won 60 ball games. What is Houston's thinking? Where are they going to draft? So there's a lot of things that go into this draft, but it all is precluded by your thoughts of taking inventory and what you think you need. Do I need to bring in an outsider? Do I need to bring in a free agent? Do I need to bring in a shooter? What about my bench? How do I look 6, 7, 8, and 9? Because the Warriors look pretty good. Now, I know a lot of people are upset with what Kevin Durant did, but he didn't break any rules. He just took advantage of the system, and he went to a team that he happened to fit in perfectly. A lot of times, that's not always the case, because you look at Carmelo, George, Russell Westbrook. How do we feel that team gelled? Do you think they gelled well together? Not all the time when you send superstars to another team, there's no guarantee that they're going to gel together. But Kevin Durant was blessed to go to Golden State because they really needed a good 3. Now they got a super, super 3 who can play 3, 4, and 5, who happens to be a guy 6'10 with a span of 7 that has taken us to another level as far as handling the ball. But if you watch the Warriors, they gel. They genuinely enjoy playing with each other. What are they going to do about the draft? Will they sit still? Do they need to bolster themselves in a way? this is a fun time of the year, guys.
Oh, absolutely. The conversation is going to be had this week leading up the draft will be a lot of fun, as you said, and see how some of these guys fit, as you said, with their new teams here in the NBA. Cassie, really appreciate the time. Thanks so much for sharing a few thoughts and memories with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, guys, thank you. God bless you for thinking of me. Keep the old guys in mind, will you?
We certainly will. Thanks so much, Cassie. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Cassie Russell joining us here on 3 and Out on this Monday afternoon. First pick overall by the New York Knicks, found out on the payphone.
Yeah.
Said, hey, we got you. Now you can go back home, and we'll pick you up. Yeah, a lot of things changed as far as that's concerned.
I think it's crazy, too. I mean, think about it. Cassie Russell, the number one pick in the draft, 1966. He's probably walking around campus. Somebody goes, is your name Cassie? Yeah, that's me. Come here. Somebody's on the phone for you. Who? The commissioner. You know, the New York Knicks just selected you a number one overall pick. And it's just the fact that now, you know, with so much pressure on these draft picks now, you look at the fact that, yeah, Kevin Durant played 1 year in college. They also retired his number. He's also one of the best players in the league. Lonzo Ball, on the other end, coming to the Lakers. They expected him to be that superstar. And it might not work out. I know, Kevin, you always talking about, if it's not a lottery pick, it don't even matter. Well, not even if you are a lottery pick. I mean, who knows? So you just hope that some of these guys can live up to it. But LeBron James, he looks big on TV, and he's even bigger in person. So I'm just saying, man, that's what you got to be able to deal with. But wishing these guys nothing but the best.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll see what happens on Thursday. We'll come back with more 3 and Out on the Southern Pigskin Radio Network, streaming live ESPNCoastal.com on your mobile device with the ESPN app.